Welcome to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
Is the perception of regionally low wages supported by the facts? How might a business improve wages while prudently managing a company's bottom line?
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, and generous support from Lane County and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's November 12, 2021 program, Finding Fairness in Wages. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I am past president of City Club of Eugene. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and our sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. In today's program, we welcome three distinguished speakers. Henry Fields is the Oregon Employment Department's workforce analyst and economist for Lane and Douglas counties. Sarah Kolick is the executive director of the Good Jobs Institute, whose mission is to help companies thrive by creating good jobs. Megan Pratt coordinates the Oregon Child Care Research Partnership, which conducts research related to child care policy at the local and state levels. Biographical information on our speakers is available on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. I would like to thank Mary Layton for coordinating today's program. Finding fairness in wages. Mainstream and social media are full of critiques of wages. Prominent among them is the claim that wages are too low, especially in Lane County, and that the gap between what basic survival costs and what a person can earn grows ever larger. Is the perception of regionally low wages supported by the facts? How might a business improve wages while prudently managing a company's bottom line? Among the lowest wage jobs are in childcare, making them difficult to attract and sustain the highly qualified workforce that is needed to care for children and enable parents to be consistent and productive workers. Despite the fact that research shows that investment in early childhood education saves money in the long run, wages for childcare workers have remained low. In this program, our three experts will share facts and ideas about wages. Henry Fields would describe the situation in Lane County and compare it with other localities. Sarah Kolick will explain some of the ways smart companies have found to offer better wages. And Megan Pratt will talk about how public policies and institutions can promote better childcare for preschoolers. Henry, we'll start with you.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Henry Fields. I am the workforce analyst for Lane and Douglas counties with the Oregon Employment Department's Research Division. And that means that I provide data on the local economy and the local labor force. So I'm here to talk a little bit about the context for finding fairness in wages, which I think is a great way to frame this discussion rather than something like the solution to low wages, because this is a very complex and difficult issue that has a lot of inputs into it. So I'm so excited to be here with the other panelists that I think are going to have some really crucial insights for us. I'm going to just share a couple data points that help us give some context in the long and medium term for what wages look like in our area, and then close with a look at what's happening right now. The big long-term context is that Lane County has lower wages than the nation as a whole. In 2020, the average wage here was about $50,000. And in Oregon, it was about $60,000. And in the United States, about $64,000. So this is a trend we've seen for a very long time. Lane County earns lower wages than Oregon, and Oregon earns lower wages than the nation. This is wages per worker, which has advantages over other measures of measuring income, in that, for example, retired and non-working students aren't counted. But it doesn't account for something like hours. So part-time workers do bring down this average somewhat. There are a million different reasons for this long-term trend, not all of which we have time to go into today. I'm just going to be isolating a few that we're going to talk a little bit more about. So some of those include, for example, our local industry makeup. If there's an industry that pays a lower wage on average and is concentrated here, that obviously lowers our average wage per worker. Social assistance is a good example of that. So childcare, for example, there are more childcare jobs here than there are in the nation as a whole, as a percentage. And if that's a low wage industry, that helps bring down the average. Another probably even more important reason is the occupational mix. That could mean something like the low wage workers in each industry are more likely to be concentrated here. So be thinking about things like low wage childcare, education and healthcare workers, retail and fast food. If those are more prevalent here than they are in other places, obviously that brings down our average wage. And it could also mean that there are high wage careers that are quote unquote absent from that would be more prevalent in other areas. And in our case, both are true. Those are both factors that feed into our lower average wage. I often get asked questions about if the student population plays a role, and the answer there is complicated, but they do. There is some role for example, students are more likely to work part-time, and that brings down the average wage. Students might hang around after graduating and bid down prices for workers with a college education. The point I really want to leave you with here is that there are a lot of issues that feed into this, rather than one single cause and one single solution that cause our wages to be lower than the state and the nation. The most concerning element for what we're talking about today is two things. One would be lower pay for the same work that you can earn somewhere else. And then the other is high costs relative to incomes, especially in careers that help the rest of our economy function. We're going to be talking a lot more about childcare, for example. And that's a great example of something that helps move our economy forward, that if local workers cannot afford to live here, we come to an obvious roadblock. And inflation is a concern as well, especially recently, which we'll talk a little bit more about. Higher housing costs, one example. For example, the median housing value in September of 2021 in the United States was about $350,000, and in Lane County is about $436,000. So in a world where workers earn less per worker, bringing home less money in their paycheck, and have higher costs, for example, in housing, which is most people's biggest budget item, you can see pretty quickly how we arrive at a point where it's difficult for workers to get by. I want to talk a little bit more about the job mix that I brought up as an idea, because I think it's really important to understand. Much of the gap in our wages comes from the different types of jobs that are here locally. There are certain types of careers, things like legal careers, management careers, business and financial, that are more likely to be concentrated in big cities. And this is a trend that you see in all sorts of mid-sized cities across the United States that contributes a lot to the wage gap there. It's just much more likely for a management level career to be located in a big city where there's lots more business connections. And that's a reality. We have less of those jobs, and the ones that are here tend to pay lower. There's also the element of a concentration of low-wage jobs, like we talked about. So for example, we have a lot of community and social service jobs. Those tend to be low wage. And on top of that, our careers locally tend to pay a little bit less than they do nationally. So you get a real triple build of that low wage situation. And then to be fair, there are some careers where there is higher pay locally, things like food prep and healthcare and farming, fishing, and forestry. Those are certain careers where you can actually earn more in Lane County. But when you look across the economy as a whole, when you average it all comes down to a few percentage points lower, and in some cases, many percentage points lower in terms of the wages you can earn locally. So that's kind of a long-term context for what we're talking about today. Let's talk a little bit more about recent trends. Some very interesting things obviously have happened in the economy since early 2020. And one of them is that wages really started to grow, average wages. At first, this was due almost entirely to negative reasons, loss of low-income jobs, because as low-income people lose their jobs, it increases the average wage. But that's obviously not an indicator of economic health or stability. What happened over the course of 2020 and into 2021 is that actually became more money in people's pockets. So accounting for the loss of those low-wage industries, it actually did become folks earning more money that they bring home with them. In recent months, those gains have leveled off relative to inflation, which we'll talk a little bit more about. But right now, the major trend that we're seeing is workers bidding up bidding up prices, essentially wages. So an example of that would be we put out a quarterly job vacancy survey to businesses across the state, asking them what jobs they have open and which jobs are difficult to fill. And in summer of 2021, they said that there were 107,000 jobs open at any given time across Oregon, which is a record for as long as we've done the survey since 2013. And additionally, they told us 78% of those jobs were considered difficult to fill, which is also a record. So with this strong demand for workers, workers are obviously in a better position to command stronger wage growth. And that's what we see in the recent history of what's happening with wages. Another way of looking at this is there's actually nationally less than one unemployed person per job opening. So what does that mean? Obviously, early in 2020, a lot of people lost their jobs, but there's been very strong hiring since then. And now, since there's less than one unemployed person per job opening, if every single unemployed person in the United States accepted an open job, there would still be jobs open. That's kind of the level of job demand that we're talking about right now. And I think it's useful context. We've also heard a lot about things like strike authorizations increasing at businesses and the number of voluntary quits being up. And those are both signs that workers really feel a relatively strong bargaining position that's creating more wage growth. Now, that being said, the real average wage growth, that is accounting for inflation, has leveled off somewhat in 2021. And that's largely as a result of inflation increasing, which has been on a lot of people's minds these days. If we look at the long or medium term, the last time our wages went up before 2020 was around 2015 or 2016. And that was, again, as a result of the Great Recession starting to really heal statewide and job demand heating up. We saw wage growth in 2020 and 2021 as a result. So that's been the recent history of what we have, what we've experienced. But in about April of 2021 or so, we started to see that level off. And a lot of that has to do with the increase in prices, which is how we determine our prices, our wages actually increasing, accounting for inflation. The important thing to know here, everyone has questions about inflation right now. I don't have a lot of answers, but I do want to highlight for folks that there's a wide range of price changes going on in the economy. So some things are not increasing in cost very much, things like medical care and travel spending. But some things like new and used cars, for example, are increasing very, very rapidly. So some of this has to do with a lack of availability of goods that may or may not have short and long-term implications. But just know that this is an important thing to keep an eye on when we're talking about wages. So as we kind of close and I hand it off to Sarah, I wanted to say that this really gets at the kind of crux of what we're dealing with a complex issue like wages. There's a lot of difficult choices that employers, workers, everyone has to make together. Many employers are limited in what they can do, and increasing their prices might help contribute to things like inflation, or others might not be able to increase their prices at all because it represents a hardship for customers. And at the same time, we have many vital workers here that can't really afford to live on their current wages that are lower than the nation. So that's obviously an economic disadvantage for us. We haven't even really had time to get into things like the equity element. There are pay gaps between workers of color, for example, and women. So there's lots more to discuss here. I did want to share, if you want to talk more about any of this, my information is available on qualityinfo.org, which is our website about any more of this data. I'd be glad to talk more about it. But I'm going to hand it off to Sarah for the more difficult part of the conversation, what things look like and what employers might be able to do about this tough situation they find themselves in. So thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Henry, and it's such a pleasure to be with you today. My name is Sarah Kallick. I'm Executive Director of the Good Jobs Institute. We are a nonprofit based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and our mission is to help companies thrive by creating good jobs. So we work with companies in the service sector, as well as investors who see good jobs as a value creation mechanism. We help companies improve their operations so that they can pay higher wages and have more stable schedules and offer better jobs, but also do that in a way that's sustainable for their business. So, Henry, you hit the nail on the head. Wages are incredibly complex and incredibly important. Matthew Desmond wrote a beautiful article in the New York Times a couple of years ago called Dollars on the Margins. And it starts with this. A living wage is an antidepressant. It's a sleep aid, a diet, a stress reliever. It's a contraceptive preventing teen pregnancy. It prevents premature death. It shields children from neglect. On the flip side, low wages have been shown to drive poor physical and mental health outcomes and make it hard for American families to plan for the future or even live a stable life today. People can't save $400 for an emergency, forget saving for retirement, for education, for a home. They can't pay rent. They can't feed their families. And this is, of course, a crisis for our communities, but it's also a crisis for companies. So if your teams are living financially precarious, unstable lives, that is going to impact your business. People have to work 2 to 3 jobs who can't afford to fix a flat tire. They may not be able to get to work. And once they're at work, they may not be able to focus. There's a great study that shows that people living under financial stress have a bandwidth tax of 13 IQ points. this vicious cycle of poverty connects and helps drive what we call a vicious cycle for companies. So this vicious cycle for companies, it starts with poor operations. So all of you have been to a retailer that has stockouts, long lines, dirty stores, a restaurant that has inconsistent food quality, manufacturers, they often have long lead times and poor quality products, a lot of operational challenges. So you're losing customers, your profits going down, and you have to cut somewhere. Companies often look to labor budgets as the first place to cut when things get tough. And with bad jobs, you can make money for a while, but eventually you cut into muscle. Your service gets worse, your operations get worse, your profits go down again, you invest less in people, those people are living even more precarious lives, and you end up in a vicious cycle that's really hard to get out of. And that's where a lot of companies find themselves now. But that was true 2 years ago pre-COVID when we had a very tight labor market in 2019 as well. So wages are going up, as Henry pointed out. Macy's just announced their starting wage is going to go up to $15. And we actually have a list of other companies who've made this commitment on our website, goodjobsinstitute.org. If you're one of those businesses, we'd love to add you to the list. But many businesses still see labor as a cost to be minimized and not their most important asset. So I'm here to tell you that investing in people does not have to be a zero-sum game. We help companies that are in that vicious cycle to get out of it. So you do need to help people stabilize and stabilize people. And that often means investments in wages and more stable schedules, better training, career paths, stronger support for managers, better benefits. And this can sound really expensive, and it often is. But if you improve your job design and your operations, you can leverage that investment in people to drive productivity, contribution, and motivation. Low wage work is hard because of low wages and unstable schedules, but it's really hard because many of these jobs are designed in a way that does not respect people's knowledge, their judgment. It does not give them the time, the tools, the resources, the autonomy that they need to succeed. And so every day you leave feeling a lack of respect and a lack of dignity that's really corrosive. And that's where the Good Jobs Strategy and the Good Jobs Institute comes in. The Good Jobs Strategy is a framework that identifies four operational choices that good jobs companies make, which, combined with investment in people, drive value for their customers, their employees, and their investors at the same time. So I can't take you through the whole Good Jobs Strategy today, but I really encourage you to check out our website. We have a ton of free resources and tools. And also to read The Good Job Strategy by my colleague Zeynep Tan. It's a fantastic book. But I would like to show you what some of these operational choices are so you can see how they can drive better service and better productivity. So the first operational choice that great companies make is focus and simplify. They have a great strategic focus. They know why their customers come to them, and they don't try to be everything to everyone. They make strategic trade-offs about what to be good at and what to offer. And then they simplify, simplify, simplify. So a typical supermarket offers 40,000 products. The great Pacific Northwest retailer Costco offers 3,000 to 4,000 in their store, right? So offering fewer products means you can reduce your costs, you can increase productivity, and your teams really know your products well, and they can really be there for your customers to help them out. The second operational choice is standardize and empower. If any of you have worked a frontline retail or restaurant job, you might have seen, you know, a tome of 300 pages of policies and processes and procedures. Companies that are in a vicious cycle with high turnover and not enough time to train people, you might at headquarters make a beautiful policy and a beautiful procedure that's super efficient, but nobody's reading that, right? So the best good jobs companies, they have strong standards, but not for everything, just for the things that would really benefit from efficiency and consistency. And at the same time, they are empowering their employees to improve those standards, to solve customer problems, and to drive continuous improvement. So great standards, but also a lot of empowerment. Cross-training. Many companies don't offer good training at all because they're in a vicious cycle, they have high turnover, they hire you, and you're right away working the cash register. But the very best companies, they train you well for your main role, but they also cross-train you so that if there's a bunch of customers in store in the restaurant, you can be at the cash register. But if there isn't, you can be doing inventory or other non-customer facing work. So there's plenty of flexibility, lots of productivity, and you're also gaining new skills. The last choice is operate with Slack. And this one really makes people nervous. Most companies try to understaff to save money, but the very best good jobs companies, they, first of all, they've simplified their work and they've reduced non-value add tasks. They have great standards, so they know how long things should take. They've improved flexibility with empowerment and with cross-training. So there's not a lot of, you know, slack in there for work-wise, but they want to make sure there's slack for their teams. So they operate with a higher than expected staff because they want to make sure that their staff can always be there for their customers, always get their tasks done and be operationally excellent and be part of continuous improvement. So these four choices: leverage investment in people to create higher performance. And if you're going to make these choices, you have to have great people to execute them. And so you get into this virtuous cycle that is really effective. So some companies like Costco, Trader Joe's, Quick Trip in the gas station convenience store chain in the Midwest, Costco and Trader Joe's, they were born this way, but you don't have to have good jobs built into your DNA. So just one example, Sam's Club is on a good jobs journey. So over the past couple of years, they have really invested in people. They raised wages for their team leads and for some key roles like butchers and cake decorators. They raised wages $5 to $7 an hour. I can't tell you how life-changing that was for those leaders in their stores to go from $13 to $20, from $15 to $22. We talked to one woman, she said it just meant freedom, right? Incredible investment. They also just raised their starting wage to $15. They introduced more consistent and predictable schedules and moved more people to full-time. But they also made operational choices that leveraged that investment to drive better service and better productivity. So they reduced their product variety by 25%. And you might think customers want all the choices. They actually had customers coming to them and saying, oh, you guys seem to have so much more in store, because they could actually see it, right? More is not always better. They removed photo centers. People just don't go to photo centers in the same way. So let's simplify what we offer so we can really offer what our customers need. They simplified their stocking process, lots of small changes to layout to become more pallet driven. So people didn't have to spend time stacking things. They could spend time with customers. They standardized tire buying processes to reduce time and improve service. And they made some investments in technology that allowed their teams to, you know, really be there for the customer. Sam's stores are big, right? So this enabled, if you're in produce, you can, and somebody asks you about toothpaste, you can help make sure that you can answer their questions. They made big, big wage investments, but they also made these operational changes and the results have been great. So they've reduced turnover in some of these key roles by as much as 49%. They've seen really strong same-store sales growth. And really key for a club, they're having higher member retention and more new members coming into shop. There are other companies who've gone through these good jobs implementations. So Quest Call Centers and a Pacific Northwest favorite, Mud Bay, a pet retailer, they're also on a good jobs journey. And you can see case studies about both of these companies on the MIT Sloan website. MIT Sloan is MIT's business school. And I'm here to tell you that the business case for good jobs is strong. And that's what I want to end with. Financially, good jobs can drive more revenue through increased loyalty and increased traffic, getting more people to buy more things more often. Good jobs can reduce cost, turnover cost, overtime, waste, legal and safety issues. Good jobs can also drive labor productivity. So we help companies simplify work and remove non-value add tasks so they can save thousands of hours of work that can be reinvested in wages. We also work with companies to look at competitive levers, both adaptability and differentiation. So good jobs companies are more adaptable. And the last 18 months between COVID and the racial reckoning that we've been working through here in the US, it's been, you know, tremendous amounts of change. But the truth is that the business landscape is always changing between new regulations, new technology, new customer demands. So you have to be adaptable. But you also want to be able to differentiate yourself through great service for your customers, but also for your employees. So some of you may remember Circuit City. It was one of the biggest electronics retailers in the 90s. Then they made the choice to cut back on full-time workers with really deep expertise. They saved $130 million making those cuts, but they ultimately doomed themselves. Best Buy was in a really challenging financial position about 10 years ago when Hubert Joly joined as CEO, and he made the absolute opposite decision from Circuit City. So he decided to double down on people and double down on service, and business is booming. Joly said, "The way we want to win is around advice, convenience, and service." So good jobs companies, they invest in people and it's the right thing to do, but they also really deeply do this because it's how they win with customers. Jim Sinegal, co-founder of Costco, says, "Paying people good wages is not altruism, it's good business." So good jobs can also differentiate you in a tight labor market. I definitely encourage everyone to do a pay analysis so that you understand if your teams are making a living wage. We have our pay analysis methodology online. We do a wage assessment with all the companies we work with, and leaders are often surprised by how many people aren't making a living wage. This can be disaggregated by race and gender. We've got a scorecard that you can use to look at other important metrics for employees. Really encourage you to do that. At the Good Jobs Institute, we focus on the service sector, and we've seen some great results in retail, hospitality, call centers, manufacturing. We've also worked in senior care. And while there are certainly operational improvements to make, the wage lever is harder in direct care because some, if not all, depends on government reimbursement rates. But the last year and a half has shown us that the care economy is our economy. For people to get back to work, they need to know that their children and their older loved ones are safe. And we have got to have good jobs in direct care. In fact, bad jobs in the direct care sector likely fueled the COVID pandemic. The National Bureau of Economic Research found that 49% of COVID cases among nursing home residents, which you may remember were a lot of the COVID cases here in the US, were attributable to staff movements between facilities. Bad jobs, having to work multiple jobs, drove this pandemic, and good jobs are going to help us get out of it. Hubert Humphrey said, "The moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped." By this measure, the US has a lot of work to do, and I'm so glad that there are leaders in Oregon who are doing that critical work. So really love to turn it over to Megan Pratt to talk more about the child care industry and the challenges and opportunities there.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Henry. My name is Megan Pratt. I am an assistant professor of practice at Oregon State University and coordinate what is known as the Oregon Child Care Research Partnership, which has been going on since about the 1990s and focuses on what the landscape of child care is in Oregon and also within that national land as well. And what I really want to focus in on today is exactly picking up a bit where Sarah left off. Good quality care and education requires an environment that values adults as well as the children. It is a problem, the issue of low wages in child care or early care and education. It has gotten new attention in the last year or so, and as well as a few years beforehand. COVID made it very clear how, when programs need to shut down, who is harmed. And it was not only clear, it was in our faces, right? The children were behind us in Zoom while we were trying to work from home. And providers were realizing we can't sustain because we rely so much on parent tuition. So I'm going to explain a little bit of what that is and what the conundrum is, particularly in this child care world. In 1989, some national experts did a study around the child care staffing. And what they found was that it's incredibly valuable work, dedicated staff, but wages were not livable. They looked back again in 2014 and found the same thing. Okay, now we know more research has been done. The Office of Child Care was developed at the federal level. We've documented all these disparities, yet it's still unlivable wages. Child care and early education providers are one of the lowest paid sectors in our economy. Focusing in on Lane County in particular, one of the things that the partnership does is it looks at what centers are able to pay their teachers. And when we look at what's happening in Lane County, what we see is that center teachers in Lane County, right before the pandemic, when we asked directors, what are you paying? They're paying anywhere from $24,000 a year to $34,000 a year for the annual income. This equates to about $13 to $18 an hour. And this can be compared to people with similar educational backgrounds in kindergarten classrooms making $48,000 to $63,000 a year. When we take that number, a really important piece of the fairness is that centers tend to be the higher paying type of care, that there's a lot of care that happens in Oregon in homes, and home-based care tends to charge less, and the providers tend to therefore have a lower income. This is also true of infant and toddler care, tends to be have a lower, the teachers and educators in those classrooms or in those programs are paid less. And then when we're talking about disproportionality, aides and support staff working are making even less. And so it's a pretty stark picture. Often what then happens when having these conversations is parents will then come and say, okay, so the workforce isn't making very much money. Why is it so expensive? And it's true, it is incredibly expensive. So right before the pandemic in Lane County, the median annual price of toddler care in a child care center was about $14,000. It's about $9,000 to $10,000 a year for public Oregon University tuition. So it's exceeding that and often is competing with mortgages, monthly costs for families, if not exceeding them for a lot of the families. And when you think about families in low income, low wage work, for a minimum wage worker, what this price ends up being is about 58% of their income would have to go to childcare to afford this center toddler price. Why is this happening? And when you boil things down, a big problem that makes it really difficult is that Oregon parents fund the majority of annual childcare expenditures. So a report that was done in 2010 from the Oregon Employment Department estimated that Oregon parents fund about 72% of childcare. This is, you can put in contrast to the K-12 system, where the majority of it is publicly funded and is coming through a single, the budget is kind of all together in one. The other thing that childcare has working against it and that a lot of people are looking to find solutions to is it's incredibly fragmented and haphazard. Childcare or early care and education can involve all sorts of different areas or different types of care with different purposes. Getting parents to work is a purpose. Supporting children who are facing disadvantaged households is a purpose of readying children and closing achievement gaps. And so this fragmentedness makes it really hard as well. And so what ends up happening is that parents are paying that $14,000 a year to a provider in a field where it's not something you can find a lot of cost efficiencies. And there's also not that economy of scale that allows for you to figure out, okay, we can trim here and here. Because what actually ends up happening is that for an infant in Oregon in a center, you can have one teacher for every four children. And so if you think of that $14,000, say you have an infant price at that cost, 60 to 80% of what's coming in from that parent is going to wages. And what we found is then that there are programs, the majority of programs in Lane County in Oregon in the United States are really struggling to keep a roof over their heads, to pay the rent that they're paying to the church that they're running their program out of, to make a repair to a fence that needs to happen. So little costs or big emergency costs can really unravel everything. The pandemic really brought this to light as well. And in Oregon, as well as in other states and across the United States, what we saw was that programs that had some sort of public funding, they had some sort of public investment through a contract, which I'll explain what that is, or a voucher, they're surviving a little bit better. Because you could imagine if you're a program and you rely 100% on parent tuition dollars, and all those parents are saying, sorry, we can't bring our kid anymore. Like, I lost my job, right? All these scenarios happened. Those places are really struggling to open back. And so public investments can really, they are improving the childcare system. There have been increases at the federal level and state and Oregon level, and community energy really moving towards, okay, we need to really find a solution here. Knowing that this is not a new problem, but an existing problem that we really have put a spotlight on. There's a couple ways that public investments are functioning now and some efforts to improve them further. The biggest bucket of money that comes through from the feds to Oregon are vouchers. And these are known in Oregon as often talked about in different ways, subsidy program, employment-related daycare. These vouchers are an agreement between the state and a parent, and they really work well when the market is working well, the childcare market is working well. So they allow parents to focus on the choice and pick, oh, I want this type of provider with this type of hours. And so they have a lot of flexibility built into them. Unfortunately, they're also unpredictable for programs. And although there's been a raise in, there's been growth in the investment into that program that does target primarily low wage working households, it's unpredictable. So if I'm a provider and I want to take in a child and care for them and they have a voucher, I know that money is going to be coming in as long as that child's there. But if the money, if the parent and child leave and go to a different program, I no longer have that income. Contracts, on the other hand, are another piece and a lever that the state has been using to build childcare supply. And they're a relationship between the state and the provider themselves. And they build, like I said, so they build supply. So in Lane County, we looked at most of Oregon, if not all of Oregon, is a childcare desert. There's not enough. What we do have is not affordable, right? 20% of that care in Lane County is publicly funded preschool slots. And so what those provide is a stable income for providers to be able to know, okay, as long as I'm within my contract, I can continue to provide care to these families. And the state can say, you should be earning a living wage. We're going to build that into the contract. And so there's a lot of ability for planning and for targeting money. They are a little more rigid. In terms of the parent perspective. Then there's a third option I wanted to throw out there, and that is so we have these national and state efforts, vouchers, contracts, another program that's been around since the 60s, Head Start, provides a lot of support to families and provides childcare solutions, is something called shared services. So national and state programs are helpful, but there is a need for empowerment at this local level, and childcare is a local issue, and every community has a different set of demands, different types of employment, different family scenarios, different preferences of how they want to solve the problem of childcare. And that's where shared services come into play. And what a shared service model is, it's an approach to childcare management to work on that financial stability by sharing or pooling resources across a network of programs. These are often thought about with small programs that don't have someone to do HR, to help with hiring, don't have someone to help with these other pieces. Collecting full fees is an incredibly difficult task and very hard because a lot of parents are struggling to provide that care. And so shared services is designed to help with that. And it also provides a way of shared leadership and this idea of a community-driven solution where providers are coming together. Right now, there's a pilot down in Coos and Curry County on the Southern Oregon coast that has been using this. And Oregon Community Foundation has identified Neighborhood House up in Portland to look at a statewide shared services alliance that pools resources and uses some novel technology and software companies who are able to help pool these things so that hiring can have help. Substitute pools is a huge issue. All these different things, and it has this local solution focus. So overall, that's just a little taste of what the big issues are. There's a lot happening and a lot potentially on the horizon. But what's really clear is that the parents are not able to afford the care, and the care matters beyond the family. And we saw that with the pandemic when parents are not able to get to work. And we know that the combination of investment and problem solving at these different levels, federal, state, and local, are essential. And so I'll go back to this 1989 study of national child care staffing that shows that we really need to invest and value those adults. So that idea that good quality care requires an environment that values the adults as well as children. And the number one way that needs to be communicated is via compensation. The rest of it doesn't matter if people aren't getting paid a living wage and feeling valued in that work.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our YouTube channel and our social media pages.